This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jerry Stahl was a TV writer, husband, father, and junkie. While he was writing Family Fun for ALF, sexual innuendos for Moonlighting, and yuppie predicaments for 30-something, he was spending a lot of time in bathrooms shooting up. Jerry Stahl had been getting high since high school. He started with pills and marijuana, then moved on to heroin when he was in his early 20s. He's been clean since 1992. Now in his early 40s, he's the divorced father of a 6-year-old daughter with whom he spends most afternoons. After he kicked, instead of going back to television, he wrote a memoir called Permanent Midnight, which is both funny and horrifying. Here's a short reading from the opening.
The temptation is to be clever, to make it all wildly amusing. I published a story once, at 30 days off the spike, about doing dope in the studio where they shot ALF, banging so much stuff in the soundstage toilet, I heard the furry little puppet hissing my name and scratching at the door. I imagined, in my narco-dementia, that this 3-foot furry TV star, no more than a puppet with attitude, could see right through the bathroom walls. ALF was out there eyeballing all the blood I'd splattered on the mirror, on my fingers, into tiny scarlet puddles at my feet. But it was a family show, and he did not approve. See, it wasn't just the dope. It never is. It was the wrongness of the situation. I wasn't Chet Baker fixing behind the bandstand and blowing his heart out. I wasn't Johnny San Quentin shooting up in his jail tattoos and boosting stereos. I was Jerry Stahl, writing bad TV and hating it, desperately trying to counter his shame at the loathsome squareness of what he did with the secret hipness of what he thought he really was. The thing is, all my heroes were junkies. Lenny Bruce, Keith Richards, William Burroughs, Miles Davis, Hubert Selby Jr. These guys were cool. They were committed. They would not have been caught dead doing an ALF episode.
Jerry Stahl, did it always feel absurd and incongruous to be a junkie writing sitcoms?
That's the best thing it felt, was absurd and incongruous. It was basically mortifying on a 24-hour basis.
What did you feel you should really be doing?
Well, I was a very pretentious young guy, and I kept thinking, you know, would Dostoevsky be cranking out this Moonlighting right now, you know? And the reality is he probably would, because he was a gambler and he needed the dough. But that was the level I was operating on. And you have to understand about TV, when you consider yourself a writer and an artist with a capital A or a little A, you think of yourself as having a voice and being original. But the thing about TV, it's not about creativity. It's the opposite. It's about sounding like the guy who wrote the pilot, so that when you write those lovable characters, they sound just like they did last week. So you're basically a high-paid parrot in a very corporate environment, and I was not really a 9-to-5 kind of guy.
You're very funny in the book. You write that perhaps underneath the Bill Burroughs facade was a Dick Van Patten dying to get out. Did you ever think that heroin was going to, like, make you hipper?
Well, the lamer I got, the more desperately I think I clung to that particular illusion, because the really most grotesque revelation and the most hideous admission for me is that I was kind of good at it, you know? It was like I was kind of half William Burroughs, half Maury Amsterdam, you know? kind of a Maury Burroughs thing going on. So that, you know, I was like this sort of borscht belt junkie guy, you know what I mean? Because I could write gags. I still can. And a part of me always loved that stuff. It's just that, you know, Rose Marie wasn't hanging out. You know what I mean? The reality was it was slightly less glamorous and intriguing than working for Aetna Life and Casualty.
Did the people at ALF or Moonlighting or any of the TV shows you worked for realize that you were a junkie?
At the time, I'd like to think they didn't. I certainly know that they probably figured, man, he sweats a lot, sure seems to get the flu and spend an awful lot of those bathroom breaks just not coming back for a really long time. But they probably just thought I had some kind of weird, you know, malarial parasite of some kind. You know, down the road, now I've run into some of these people, they said, no, we didn't think you were a junkie. We just thought you were kind of weird and damp.
Weird and damp?
Well, you know, you always sweat a lot when you run out of stuff. And then when you shoot the stuff, you get a little kind of moist. And, of course, I always had to wear long sleeves, even on scorching, you know, 190-degree L.A. days, which is kind of a dead giveaway. But as I said before, it is such a square environment that I don't think it occurred to them that while they were bringing in their cappuccino and croissant, I was bringing in my rigs and Dilaudids.
Was it easier for you to write for programs that you had contempt for than it would have been to write something that you took really seriously?
Absolutely true. That is the story of my life. If I didn't care about it and thought it was dreck, I was really great at it, which is probably why I drifted more and more towards these kind of jobs for which I had contempt, which, if we can get real kind of dime store Freudian, was probably just because I had a lot of contempt for myself, you know, which is why I was doing those jobs. But you can sort of allay that self-loathing with the fact that they're just throwing money at you by the fistful. I mean, I had hundreds just spilling out of my pockets when I was in television.
Did you have to fake it a lot while you were working for television and getting high all the time?
Well, the beautiful thing about heroin is, you know, beautiful thing, listen to me. The thing that made it work and was actually most hideous about it is it induced a kind of faux conviviality. So that the only way I could muster the enthusiasm while taking the meetings to seem like, yeah, that's a great idea, Alf goes to a psychiatrist, was to get high and just find the right chemical balance so that I went in. And these guys were just, God, he's just such a warm, understanding fellow, you know? And I would take these great meetings so that when I was face to face, I gave the appearance for 15 minutes of sort of being on the beam and concentrated and sharing their enthusiasm until, of course, I was back in my hovel, you know, staring at this electric, wondering what the hell I had gotten myself into and where were the drugs.
So you were pretty good at faking things.
I was terribly good. At one time, I had lined up a pilot, a movie deal, a memoir for somebody else. I think it was Frank Zappa's memoir, of all things, to be ghostwritten. And I was still on Moonlighting. And subsequently, these people would call and say, where is the script? And I would be, well, what script? And then my agent would just have another minor aneurysm and get me out of it.
Jerry Stahl is my guest, and he's written a memoir about his years as a junkie. Several of those years, he was also writing for TV shows. His memoir is called Permanent Midnight. There was a period when you were making about $5,000 a week, but you say you were shooting about six. How much do you shoot a day for $6,000 worth of heroin?
Well, by that time, it wasn't just heroin. I was shooting coke as well. So I was shooting a few grams of heroin, which is about 100 a pop.
How many syringes worth is that?
I was just kind of around the clock, maybe a couple times an hour, especially when you start shooting speedballs, the late John Belushi's favorite drug.
That's cocaine and heroin.
That's cocaine and heroin. When you start shooting coke, it's not like heroin where you can really shoot it and then do it a couple hours later. You just become a human pincushion. You literally cannot stop fixing. So at that point, I was just a complete drug glutton.
How did you get out of television completely?
I fell out. You have to understand, it is very hard to fail in Hollywood at that level because the only reason people are giving you money is because the last people gave you money. It has nothing to do with talent. So I just blew gig after gig and basically disappeared off the map.
Jerry Stahl is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Permanent Midnight. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jerry Stahl, he's written a new memoir about his former life as a TV writer and junkie. Here's what I'd like to know. I mean, you're a very educated guy. So you knew about how addicting heroin is, and you'd already had a lot of idols in music and literature who died as a result of their habits. So when you shot heroin the first time, did you think that you'd take your chances? I mean, knowing how dangerous it was?
Well, I wasn't viewing it as a career move at the time. I had been high pretty much every day for maybe 15 or 16 on one thing or another, so it was no big deal to try another drug. And long-term planning was not really my forte, so I guess I didn't look at the larger picture. At that moment, it was the right thing to do, and I dug it.
Did you have friends who were doing it?
Oh, yeah, I did. In the beginning, and in L.A., I hung out with, some people who were doing it for a while. But, you know, by the end, it was just me. And when I was in TV, it was just me.
I know that your father committed suicide and your mother tried and failed but landed in a coma for a while. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that your family was, like, predisposed to, terrible depression. Do you think that that somehow contributed to your use of drugs?
Well, I definitely had the misery gene, that's for sure, that made drugs for me very appealing because on some level they kept me alive for a long time. I don't think I could have gotten through my teens and my 20s, which both of which are essentially like a black hole, without being high all the time. And
Why not?
Because it was the only way I could not face what I had been through growing up and how depressed I was and all the weirdness and terror and deep-rooted torment I couldn't even handle. So I'm not advocating it, and it would have been much better probably to go to terrific shrinks and have it all ironed out. But for me, in that situation, pot and hallucinogens and speed and downs and what have you, it sort of just kept me afloat. In some ways, I feel very fortunate that I was able to just hit the bottom and collapse like I did, because now that I'm clean, I don't have to worry about working through all those problems. It's just gravy that I'm even walking around.
A lot of people who have given up alcohol or drugs say that you have to hit bottom before you can really give it up. Seems to me you hit bottom several times and kept going back for more. I mean, like, one of the times you hit bottom and it wasn't over yet was when your baby was born. Do you want to tell what happened?
I tell it only because it shows where you can go, and it illustrates the fact that when you are a junkie, no matter what's going on, what you are is a junkie taking care of your habits. So to make a long story short, I was in the OBGYN men's room while my daughter was being delivered, and I had ducked in there to get off, and right in the middle of it, the nurse came in and said, "Hey, it's happening, put on these scrubs." And of course, as I said before, I didn't wear short-sleeve shirts, and scrubs are a sterile short-sleeve garb that you wear in the delivery room. And I put those on rather hastily and ducked into the room where my child was being delivered at that very moment. And of course, I hadn't cleaned myself up. I was still bleeding slightly from the crook of my arm. And I looked at the doctor, and I just saw this level of contempt in his eyes, for which there's really no adjective. And he just looked at me as if to say, with a father like you, that child might as well go back where she came from, because what chance does she have? And to make matters worse, soon enough, the baby was born, and the nurse is handing me the scissors and saying, "Cut the umbilical." And at that moment, it's as if I had never done heroin before, and the rush was like one I had never experienced. I was weak in the knees and seeing double. And I kind of lurched forward to cut the umbilical cord, and by the grace of God, I avoided giving my child a third eye or my wife an impromptu hysterectomy and managed to cut the cord. But that was the mother of all bottoms. But as you say, it didn't stop me.
How come you think it didn't stop you? I mean, I'm just trying to understand more about what addiction's like, because people say, you know, you bottom out and that helps you, but it's hard to imagine much more of a bottom than that.
It's very simple. It is such a horrifying thing to have done that the mere memory of it, the mere realization that it happened, was so horrifying to me that I had become such an animal that I had to get high to obliterate the recollection of what I had done.
So was there another bottoming out that led you to actually want to kick as opposed to using more drugs to obliterate the memory?
I was always trying. I was in hospitals, rehabs, halfway houses. I kicked, as they say, in the street, cold turkey a number of times. But what it took for me was during the L.A. uprising, when I was living in a garage and had no car and no bathroom and was just kind of on a concrete floor. And one day the Rodney King thing went down and I was stumbling south to get a Perrier to 7-Eleven or some water or something. And I noticed that the 7-Eleven looked different, and of course what it was a Buick sticking out of the plate glass window. And I stumbled in and got my water and subsequently got rounded up by the cops and had the horrific revelation I was being arrested for looting a Perrier, which is about the whitest thing a man can do. And this being L.A., this cops, you know, kept all the people of color and said, you get the hell out of here. And I went back to the garage and I tried to go catch a bus to cop and the buses weren't running. And I tried to call my connection and the phones were dead. So over the course of those days, the city was burning and so was I. And I finally stumbled out, I guess, two and a half days later, completely naked in this patch of grass staring at the skies. It was kind of raining black feathers or something, as if I had died and awoken in a Garcia Marquez story. And what that was, of course, was ash. It was, the sky was black from all the burning buildings. And I just came to, like that moment in The Wizard of Oz when the house stops spinning and Dorothy steps out and the movie goes from black and white to color. I made it to the other side.
So did you kick alone in the garage?
Yeah. Completely alone, cut off, and just occasionally staring at this image when the power was on of people looting buildings and seeing my face reflected on the TV screen so that it was as if people were looting appliances out of my forehead. And I just remember thinking, you know, go ahead, take it. You know, whatever is in my head, I don't need anymore.
So what is your life like now? It's been how many years that you've been clean?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. I'm really a very boring guy. You know, I'm just, I don't drink. I only have coffee on like national holidays because at this point my liver lives out of state. I washed ashore. You're laughing. I'm dying. I have hepatitis C.
That is more Amsterdam.
I have the cello right here and I'll be happy to play a tune and Pickles is waiting in the wings. You know, I live a very dull life on one level, but for a dope fiend who's been where I've been, you know, if you're a junkie, life is very black and white. You know everything that's going to happen. You either have the dope or you don't. It's real simple. You're going to be sick. You're going to be well. Now that I'm clean, every day is nothing but gray area. It's really the last frontier. I think it's the sheer novelty and weirdness of life on the Natch that keeps me plugging away. So, you know, I write in the mornings, whatever. Take care of my daughter in the afternoons, pick her up at school.
When you were writing back in the days when you were getting high all the time, you were, mm-hmm. you know, writing for television, you were writing for things you had contempt for. Then you not only had to deal with living without drugs, but you started to write a memoir, something that you couldn't have contempt for. I mean, you had to write something that you were able to stand by. You can't blame it on the guy who wrote the pilot or on the producer, or on the taste of the American public. It's your writing. Did that make everything even harder? Or was that a good opportunity to really throw yourself into something that you cared about?
Both of those things. It was terrifying on one level because, as you say, there's no place to hide. And for me, having written high all my life, what you realize was words for me were a means of sort of obfuscating the truth. You know, you could use words to dance around anything real. And I was very much about style and less about substance. I was a flashy, kind of gonzoed out writer and never wrote about myself. Probably never wrote an honest word, for that matter. And suddenly I get clean, and I had given up writing because I was so convinced I couldn't do it anymore. Then I published an article in a magazine out here called LA Style, and from that got the book deal. And then it just became this weird sort of, once I started, it was as if I had been waiting my whole life to spill these beans, you know. It was just one long exhalation. To say it was a catharsis is almost an understatement. It was just like a sustained explosion. I wrote 1,200 pages in about 9 months, which is mortifying in itself. But, you know, having done that and gotten through the other side and edited it down to 400, leaving a lot of the gnarly stories on the floor, I just really feel like that is over, thank God. And, you know, whatever's left is left, but I guess I can relax a little bit.
How's your health now?
Put it this way, the only reason I would like to write TV now is to get some dental insurance and be able to get a checkup. I have hepatitis C, which You know, it's not AIDS, which is a bullet that I luckily dodged, but it's what a lot of junkies in the late 80s and 90s washed up with, because bleach kills the AIDS and it doesn't kill this. And what that means is basically you get tired a lot. You sort of have the stamina of a 90-year-old woman with a walker, you know, although for the first 3 hours of the day you're fine and you're supposed to be on interferon, which of course I've never done. But by and large, it's fine, except when I collapse at 2 in the afternoon, then it's a little dicey.
Back in your drug days, you used to wear black all the time, long sleeves, black leather coat. Do you still dress the same way?
I'm all about festive pastels now, Terry. I just think it's all about mauve, and you know, it's just how I am. Right now, if you could see me, it's just a cornucopia of pastel. Everything's changed about me.
So tell me, do you have
white shoes? I'm going to full Cleveland. White shoes, white belt, full leisure. I look great.
So are you going to be writing more? Obviously, you will.
Well, there's no heavy lifting. So, yeah, I'm working on a novel now. I just signed with the agent at William Morris, who represents Gore Vidal and James Michener. So I figure if he's going to go down that route and represent the likes of me, I should probably write something. So I got about 90 pages of a book and 40 pages of another novel, and we'll see. And I just spent some time in Miami with, of all people, Cindy Crawford for Buzz Magazine. So kind of getting my feet wet back in the feature journalism world, and stranger things have happened, but hey, I'm just happy not to be connected to a machine, you know?
Yeah. Well, Jerry Stahl, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was terrific.
Jerry Stahl has written a new memoir called Permanent Midnight. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.